Tria led Kurtz and his band of bounty hunters back to the camp where Jim Courtney had stampeded their horses, the camp from which they had begun the long march back to the colony. Many weeks had passed since that night, and in the meantime there had been high winds and heavy rainfall in the mountains. To any other eye than Clear's, the elements had washed away every last vestige of the sign. Clear worked outwards from the old campsite, following the direction of the stampede, then instinctively divining the direction in which Jim would have driven the stolen herd once he had it under control again. A quarter of a league from the old camp, he picked out the faintest trace of the spoor, the scrape of a steel horseshoe on shale that could not have been made by the hoof of an Eland bull or any other wild game. He aged the sign. It was not too fresh, nor too old. This was the first peg upon which he began to build the picture of the chase. He worked away from it, searching in the sheltered places, between two rocks, in the lee of fallen trees, in the malleable clay of a donga bottom, in the stratas of shale soft enough to bear an imprint and hard enough to retain it. Kurtz and his men followed at a distance, careful not to overtread and spoil the ancient sign. Often, when the spoor was so ethereal as to be obscured from even Clear's sorcery, they unsaddled their horses and waited, smoking and bickering, playing dice, gambling for the reward money they would win with the capture of the fugitives. At last, Clear, with infinite patience, would unravel that part of the puzzle. He would call them, and they would mount up and follow him on through the mountains. Gradually the sign became fresher as he narrowed the gap between them and their quarry, and Clear moved along it with more confidence. Nonetheless, it was 3 weeks after picking up that first faint hoofprint that Clear caught up with the wandering herd of mules and horses that Jim and Buckhart had used to lure them on, then abandoned. At first Kurtz could not understand how they had been gulled. Here were their horses, but no human beings with them. Since the first day he had encountered great difficulty communicating with Clear, for the bushman's Dutch was rudimentary and hand signs were not adequate for explaining the complicated nature of the deceit that Buckhart had played upon them. Then it dawned upon Kurtz that the best horses were missing from this herd of strays. Frost, Crow, Lemon, Stag, and of course Drumfire and Trueheart. "They split off and left this bunch of animals to lead us away," Kurtz had understood at last, and he blanched with fury. "For all this time we have been wandering in circles while those criminals get clear away in another direction?" His anger needed a focus, and that was clear. "Catch that yellow rat," he shouted at Richter and Larisch. "I want some skin from this stinking little Schwarzer." They grabbed the bushman before he realized their intention. "Tie him to that tree," Kurtz pointed out a large cripplewood. They were enjoying this. Their anger with the bushman was every bit as intense as Kurtz's. He was directly responsible for their hardship and discomfort over the past months, and retribution would be sweet. They bound him with leather thongs at ankles and wrists. Kurtz tore off Clear's leather breechcloth and left him naked. "Hoffel!" Kurtz shouted to the Hottentot trooper. "Cut me a bundle of thorn branches this thick." He made a circle of thumb and forefinger. "Leave the thorns on them." Kurtz shrugged off his leather coat and windmilled his right arm, loosening the muscles. Hoffel came up from the bank of the stream with an armful of thorn branches, and Kurtz took his time selecting one that had a pleasing whip and rigidity. Clear watched him with huge eyes as he strained at his bonds. Kurtz chopped the thorns off the butt end of the stick of his choice, so they would not prick his own fingers, but the rest of the limber wand bristled with the red-tipped spikes. He flourished the scourge as he advanced on Clear. "Now, you little reptile, you have led me a fine fandango, but it's your turn to dance now." He swung the first cut across Clear's shoulder blades. The cane raised a welt upon it, studded with an irregular rash of thorn punctures, from each of which oozed a drop of blood. Clear howled with pain and outrage. "Sing, you bastard mating of baboons," Kurtz told him with grim satisfaction. "You must learn that you cannot take Herminius Kurtz for a fool." He swung again. The green branch began to disintegrate with the force of the blows, and the thorns broke off and embedded themselves in Clear's flesh. Clear twisted and fought against his bonds until his wrists were rubbed bloody and raw by the leathered loops. In a voice too loud for his little frame, he screamed his fury and his vows of revenge in a language that the white man could not understand. "You will die for this, you white hyena, you eater of dung, you copulator with corpses. I shall kill you with the slowest of my poisons, you drinker of snake's piss and monkey sperm." Coots discarded the broken branch and selected another. He wiped the sweat off his face with the sleeve of his shirt and began again. He kept it up until both he and Clea were exhausted. His shirt was sodden and his breathing hoarse. Clea hung silently on the leather thongs, and the blood ran in dark snakes down his back and buttocks to drip into the dust between his feet. Only then did Kurt step back. "Leave him hanging there tonight," he ordered. "He should be in a more willing mood by the morning. Nothing like a good thrashing to get these Schwarzers working properly." Slowly, Clea turned his head and looked into Kurtz's face. He spoke softly. "I will give you the death of 20 days. You will plead with me to kill you at the end." Kurtz did not understand the words, but when he saw the hatred in Clea's beady black eyes, he understood the sense and stepped back involuntarily. "Corporal Richter," he said, "we will have to keep him tied up until he gets over his sore back and his murderous temper." He picked up Clea's quiver of poisoned arrows and tossed it onto the fire. "Don't let him have any weapon until he's learned his lesson. I don't want it between my shoulder blades. They are treacherous bastards, these little apes." In the morning, Hoffel used the point of his bayonet to dig the thorns out of the punctures that covered Clea's back, but some had been driven in too deeply. Over the following days they festered and suppurated before they sloughed to the surface. With the fortitude of a wild thing, Clea recovered his strength and agility swiftly. His expression was inscrutable, and only when he looked at Kurtz did the hatred gleam out of those anthracite dark eyes. "Drink the wind, Clea," Kurtz cuffed him casually, as he would a recalcitrant dog. "And don't look at me like that, or I'll waste another thorn tree on your stinking hide." He pointed back along the trail that had led them to this place. "Now go back and find where Jim Courtney split his spoor." They retraced their footsteps over the ground they had covered during the last 10 days. They followed Clea. Gradually his torn back clotted with festering scabs as his injuries started to heal. However, it seemed that the beating had indeed been beneficial, for he worked hard. He seldom lifted his eyes from the ground except to study the lie of the terrain ahead. They went swiftly, for he had their own tracks to use as a marker. Sometimes he followed a spur for a short way until it proved false or illusory, then returned to the main trail. At last they reached the stratum of black igneous rock beside the waterfall. On the way out they had passed this spot with only a brief pause. Even though this seemed an ideal location for Buckart to stage a deception, Clea's suspicions had been only mildly excited. Almost immediately he had picked up the strong, clear spoor on the further side of the stratum and followed it away. Now he shook his head as he returned to the spot. "Aye, I was a fool. Now I can smell Buckart's treachery in the air." He sniffed like a dog getting a whiff of the chase. He reached the place where Buckart had cast the masking spell, and he picked up a fragment of black ash. He examined it carefully and saw it was the ash of the tong tree, the wizard's tree. "Here he burned the tong and cast his spell to cheat me. I walked past this place with my eyes blinded." He was angry at having been so easily deluded by a man he considered his inferior in cunning and wizardcraft. He went down on his hands and knees and snuffled the earth. This is where he would have pissed to cover his scent. But the traces were months old, and even his nose could distinguish no residual ammoniac odour of Buckart's urine. He stood up again and made a sign of separation to Coots, laying the palms of his hands together, then parting them with a swimming motion. "This is the place," he said in execrable Dutch, pointing left and right. "Horses go that way, man go that way. By the blood of the crucifixion, this time you had better be right, or I will have your balls. Do you understand?" "No, understand." Clea shook his head. Kurtz reached down and seized a handful of Clea's genitalia, and with his other hand drew his dagger. He lifted Clear on tiptoe by his scrotum, then made the gesture of drawing the blade across the stretched sack, almost touching the skin, but shaving past it by a hair's breadth. "Cut your balls," he repeated. "Verstaan?" Clear nodded soundlessly, and Kurtz pushed him away. "Get on with it, then." They camped on the bank above the waterfall, and Clear worked both banks of the river for 3 miles upstream and down. First he covered the water's edge, but in the last 10 days or so the river had come down in spate, then subsided again. At the high water mark, dry grass and debris were stranded in the branches of the trees that grew along the banks. Not even the heaviest trodden spoor could have survived the inundation. Next, Clear moved out from the river bank, climbing up the slopes to the highest point that the floodwaters had reached. He worked the ground painstakingly, scrutinizing every inch. All his experience and magic yielded nothing. The trail was gone, washed away. He had no way of knowing whether Bakat had gone upstream or down. He had come up against an impenetrable wall. Kurtz's nerves were already raw, and when he realized that Clear had failed again, he flew into a fit of fury more vicious than the last. He had Clear bound again, but this time they hung him by his heels over a smouldering fire, which Kurtz stoked carefully with green leaves. Clear's peppercorn hair frizzled in the heat, and he coughed, choked, and retched in the smoke as he writhed and swung on the rope's end. The rest of the band broke off their dice game to watch. They were all thoroughly bored and dispirited by this time, and the lure of the reward was waning as the trail grew colder each day. Richter and Lariche had already started muttering threats of mutiny, of abandoning the pursuit, escaping from these harsh and merciless mountains, and heading back to the colony. "Ah, kill the little monkey," said Lariche in a tone of disinterest. "Have done with him, and let's go home." Instead, Kurtz stood up and drew his knife, slashed the rope that held Clear suspended, and the little man dropped headlong into the coals. He let out another shriek and rolled out of the fire, only slightly more singed than he had been already. Kurtz grabbed the end of the rope that was still round his ankles and dragged Clear to the nearest tree. He tied him there and left him, while he went back to eat the midday meal. Clear crouched against the trunk of the tree, muttering to himself and examining his injuries. When Kurtz had finished eating, he flicked the coffee grounds out of his mug and shouted for Hoffel. The Hottentot went with him to the tree, and they both looked down at Clear. "I want you to tell this little bastard in his own language that I am going to keep him tied up. He will receive no water or food, and I will beat him every day until he does his job and finds the spoor again." Hoffel translated this threat. Clear hissed angrily and covered his face to show how the sight of Kurtz offended him. "Tell him I'm in no hurry," Kurtz instructed. "Tell him I can wait until he shrivels up and dries in the sun like the baboon turd that he is." In the morning, Clear was still tied to the tree, but while Kurtz and his troopers were eating a breakfast of grilled corn cakes and smoked Dutch sausage, Clear called out to Hoffel in the language of the San. The Hottentot went to squat in front of him, and they spoke together quietly for a long time. Then Hoffel came back to Kurtz. "Clear says that he can find Somoya for you." "Well, he's not done a good job of it so far." Kurtz spat a piece of sausage skin into the fire. "He says that the only way to find the spoor now is to work a solemn magic." Lariche and Richter guffawed scornfully, and Lariche said, "If we have come to witchcraft, then I am spending no more time here. I am going back to the Cape, and Kayser can stick his reward up his asshole." "Shut your fat face," Kurtz told him, and turned back to Hoffel. "What kind of solemn magic is this?" "There is a sacred place in the mountains where the spirits of the San have their abode. There, their power is strongest. Gia says that if we go to this place and sacrifice to the spirits, Somoya's tracks will be revealed." Lariche stood up. "I have heard enough of this mumbo-jumbo. I have listened to it for almost 3 months, and we are still no nearer having the gold guilders in hand." He picked up his saddle and began to walk towards where his horse was grazing. "Where are you going?" Kurtz asked. "Are you deaf or just stupid?" Lariche asked belligerently, and placed his right hand on the hilt of his sabre. "I told you once, but I will tell you again. I am going back to the Cape." It is called desertion and dereliction of duty, but I can understand why you want to go, Kurtz said in such a mild tone that Larish looked surprised. Kurtz went on, If anyone else wants to go with Larish, I will not stop them. Richter stood up slowly. I think I will, he said. Good, said Kurtz. But leave any VOC property when you go. What do you mean, Kurtz? Larish demanded. The saddle and bridle, Kurtz said. The musket and your sabre are all company issue. The horse and, of course, your boots and uniform, not to mention your water bottle and blanket. Kurtz smiled. Just leave all that over there and you can say goodbye. Richter had not yet committed himself, so he sat down again hurriedly. Larish stood uncertainly, looking from Kurtz to his grazing horse. Then, with a visible effort, he steeled himself. Kurtz, he said, the first thing I will do when I get back to the Cape, even if it costs me 5 guilders, is fuck your wife. Kurtz had recently married a beautiful young Hottentot girl. Her name was Nella, and she had been one of the most famous filles de joie in the colony. Kurtz had married her in an attempt to gain exclusive rights to her bountiful charms. That ruse had not been entirely successful, and he had already killed one man who had not understood the niceties of holy wedlock. Kurtz glanced at Sergeant Urdemann, his old comrade-in-arms. Urdemann was as bald as an ostrich egg, but he had a fine dark moustache. He understood Kurtz's unspoken orders, and he let one eyelid droop in acknowledgement. Kurtz stood up and stretched like a leopard. He was tall and lean, and his pale eyes were dangerous beneath the colourless lashes. "One other item I forgot to mention," he said ominously. "You can leave your testicles here also. I am coming to get them from you." With a metallic scraping, he drew his own sabre and walked towards Larish. Larish dropped his saddle and spun to face him, his blade leaping from the scabbard in a flash of sunlight. "A long time I have waited for a chance at you, Kurtz. Now you have it," Kurtz said, and lifted his point. He drifted in closer, and Larish raised his own blade. Steel tapped lightly on steel as they measured each other. They knew one another well. They had trained and practiced together over the years. They drew apart and circled. "You are guilty of desertion," said Kurtz. "It is my duty to arrest you or to kill you," he smiled. I prefer the second option. Larish scowled and ducked his head aggressively. He was not as tall as Kurtz, but he had long simian arms and powerful shoulders. He attacked with a series of lunges, driving in hard and fast. Kurtz had been expecting this. Larish lacked finesse. Kurtz faded away before him, and when he reached the limit of his extension, Kurtz riposted with the strike of a puff adder. Larish jumped back only just in time, but his sleeve was split, and a few drops of blood dripped from the scratch on his forearm. They engaged again, steel scraping and thrilling on steel, but they were neatly matched. They broke and circled, Kurtz trying to move him towards where Odermann lounged against the trunk of a thorn tree. Over the years, Kurtz and Odermann had developed an understanding. Twice, Kurtz almost had Larish in position for Odermann to deal with him, but each time he moved out of the trap. Odermann left the thorn tree and moved out towards the cooking fire, as if to refill his coffee mug, but he kept his right hand behind his back. He usually went for the kidneys. A blade in the small of the back would paralyze the victim, and Kurtz would finish off Larish with a thrust through the throat. Kurtz changed the direction and angle of his attack, squeezing Larish back towards where Odermann waited. Larish jumped back and whirled suddenly, nimble as a ballerina. In the same instant, he slashed his blade across the knuckles of Odermann's hand, which held the dagger. The knife flew out of his nerveless fingers, and Larish spun back to face Kurtz. He was still smiling. "Why don't you teach your dog a new trick, Kurtz? I have seen that one too many times before, and it's becoming boring." Odermann was swearing and clutching his injured hand, and Kurtz was clearly disconcerted by Larish's unexpected ploy. He glanced at his accomplice, and as his eyes left Larish's face, Larish attacked en flèche, the attack of the arrow. He went straight for Kurtz's throat. Kurtz stumbled back and lost his footing. He went down on one knee, and Larish pressed home to end it. At the last moment he saw the flare of triumph in Kurtz's pale eyes and tried to turn aside. But his right foot was leading, and Kurtz went in low, cutting under his guard. The razor steel sliced through the back of Larish's boot, and there was an audible pop as it severed his Achilles tendon. Kurtz was on his feet again in the same instant, and sprang back outside even Larish's long reach. "There's a new trick for you, Corporal, and how do you like it?" he asked. "Now, pray tell me, who has fucked whom?" Blood was spurting from the gash in the back of Larish's boot, and he hopped back on his good leg, dragging his crippled foot behind him. His expression was desperate as Kurtz came in again fast, cutting and thrusting at his face. On one leg, Larish could not hope to hold him off, and he toppled over backwards. As he sprawled, Kurtz made the next cut with the precision of a surgeon. He slashed through the back of Larish's left boot, and his other tendon parted cleanly. Kurtz ran his sabre back into its scabbard and walked away from him contemptuously. Larish sat up, and with shaking hands and pale, sweating face, drew off his boots one at a time. He stared silently at the terrible, crippling injuries. Then he tore the hem off his shirt and tried to bind up the wounds, but the blood soaked swiftly through the grubby cloth. "Break camp, Sergeant," Kurtz called to Uderman. "Everyone mounted and ready to leave in 5 minutes. The bushman is taking us to this sacred place of his." The troop rode out of the camp in single file, following Thea. Uderman was leading Larish's horse, and his musket, water bottle, and all his other equipment were tied to the empty saddle. Larish crawled after them. "Wait! You can't leave me here!" He tried to stand, but he had no control of his feet, and he toppled over again. "Please, Captain Kurtz, have mercy! In the name of Jesus, at least leave me my musket and water bottle!" Kurtz turned his horse back and looked down at Larish from the saddle. "Why should I waste valuable equipment? Soon you will have no further use for it." Larish crawled towards him on his hands and knees, his crippled feet flopping and dragging behind him like stranded fish. Kurtz backed his horse away, keeping just out of his reach. "I can't walk, and you have taken my horse," he pleaded. "It's not your horse, Corporal. It belongs to the VOC. Kurtz pointed out, "but I have left you your boots and your testicles. That is enough generosity for one day." He turned his horse's head and rode after the rest of his troop. "Please!" Larish screamed after him. "If you leave me here, I will die." "Yes," Kurtz agreed over his shoulder, "but probably not until the vultures and the hyenas find you." He rode away. The sound of the horse's hoofs faded, and the silence of the mountains pressed down upon Larish with such weight that he felt the last shreds of his courage and resolve crushed beneath it. It did not take long before the first vulture planed overhead on widespread wings. It twisted its head on the long, naked red neck and peered down at Larish. Then, satisfied that he was crippled and moribund and unable to protect himself, it circled in for a landing on the rocky pinnacle above him. It flared its massive wings and stretched out its talons to find purchase on the rock. Then it settled, humpbacked, folded away the long wings and watched him impassively. It was an enormous bird, black and lappet-faced. Larish crawled to the nearest tree and leaned against the trunk. He gathered every stone within reach, but they made a pathetically small pile. He hurled one at the crouching vulture, but the range was long, and from a sitting position his throw lacked power. The great bird blinked its eyes but made no other movement. A dead branch had fallen from the tree and lay just within Larish's reach. It was too heavy and too awkwardly shaped to wield effectively. Nevertheless, he placed it across his lap. It was his weapon of last resort. But when he studied the great bird, he knew just how puny it was. They watched each other for the rest of that day. Once the vulture ruffled out its feathers, then preened them carefully and settled into immobility again. By nightfall, Larish was thirsty, and the pain in his feet was almost unbearable. The brooding silhouette of the bird was satanic black against the background of stars. Larish thought about creeping up upon it as it slept and strangling it with his bare hands, but when he tried to move, the pain in his feet held him as effectively as leg irons. The midnight cold drained his vital force, and he sank into a delirious sleep. The faint warmth of the sun on his face and the dazzle of it in his eyes roused him. For many seconds he did not know where he was, but when he tried to move, the pain in his feet held him fast and brought back the horrors of his predicament in full force. He groaned and turned his head, then screamed wildly with shock. The vulture had come down from its perch on the rocky pinnacle. It sat close by, just out of reach. He had not realized the size of the creature. It seemed to tower over him as he sat. Close up, it was even more hideous. Its naked head and neck were raw, scaly red, and it reeked of carrion. He snatched up a stone from the pile at his side and hurled it with all his strength. It glanced off the vulture's gleaming funereal plumage. The creature spread its huge wings, wider than he was tall, and hopped back a little, then folded them again. "Leave me, you foul beast!" he sobbed with terror. At the sound of his voice it raised its feathers and ducked the monstrous head on its shoulders, but that was its only reaction. The day drew on, and the heat of the sun rose until Larish felt that he was trapped in a bread oven, barely able to breathe, and his thirst became a terrible torment. The vulture sat like a carved cathedral gargoyle and watched him. His senses reeled, and the darkness drew in on him. The bird must have sensed it also, for suddenly it spread its wings like a black canopy. It uttered a guttural squawk and bounded towards him, hopping on spread talons. Its hooked beak gaped wide open. Larish howled with terror, snatched up the stick from his lap, and struck out wildly. He fetched the vulture a blow along its naked neck with just enough force to knock it off balance. But it used its wings to recover and hopped back out of his reach again. It folded its wings and resumed its inscrutable vigil. It was the vulture's indefatigable patience that drove him beyond the bounds of sanity. He raved at it through lips swollen with thirst and cracked by the baking sun until the blood dripped from his chin. The vulture never moved, except to blink its glittering eyes. In his madness, he threw his precious stick at its head, his weapon of last resort. The vulture lifted its wings and croaked as the stick glanced off its armoured plumage. Then it settled down again to wait. The sun reached its zenith, and Larish raved and shouted, challenging God and the devil, swearing at the patient bird. He scratched up handfuls of dust and sand to throw at it until his fingernails were broken off to the quick. He sucked his bleeding fingers to find moisture to slake his thirst, but the dirt clogged his swollen tongue. He thought about the stream they had crossed on their way here, but it was at least half a mile back down the valley. The picture of the cold tumbling waters excited his dementia. He left the illusionary shelter of the thorn tree and started crawling slowly back along the rocky pathway towards the river. His feet flopped along behind him, and the crusted saber cuts burst open and started bleeding again. The vulture smelt the blood, squawked hoarsely, and hopped along behind him. Larish covered less than 100 paces and told himself, "I will rest for a while." He lowered his face onto his arm and lapsed into unconsciousness. The pain woke him. It was as though a dozen spearheads were being driven into his back. The vulture was perched between his shoulder blades, its curved talons locked deeply in his flesh. It was flapping its wings to maintain its balance as it lowered its head, and with a slash of its beak tore away his shirt. Then it stuck in the hooked, pointed tip and ripped away a long strip of his flesh. Larish screamed hysterically and rolled over, trying to crush the bird under his own body, but with a flap of its wings it rose and settled again close by. Although his eyesight was blurring and wavering, he watched it swallow his flesh, stretching its neck and gulping to force it down. Then it lifted its head and turned its eyes upon him again, holding his gaze unflinchingly. He knew that it was waiting for him to slip once more into unconsciousness. He sat up and tried to remain alert, singing and shouting at it and clapping his hands, but slowly his voice became an incoherent mumble. His arms fell to his sides, and his eyes closed. This time, when he came awake, he could not believe the intensity of the pain that overwhelmed him. There was a battering whirlwind of wings around his head, and it felt as though a steel hook had been driven through his eye socket, that his brains were being drawn out of his skull. He thrashed around weakly on his back, no longer with the strength to cry out and try to open his eyes, but he was blind and could feel sheets of hot blood pouring down his face, filling his good eye, mouth and nostrils, so that he was drowning in it. He reached up with both hands, clutched at the bird's scaly neck, and realized that the bird had driven its beak deep into one of his eye sockets. It was pulling out his eyeball on the long, rubbery string that contained the optic nerve. They always go for the eyes, he thought, with final resignation, past any further resistance. Blinded and now too weak to lift his hands, he listened to the bird somewhere close at hand, gulping down his eyeball. He tried to peer at it through his remaining eye, but it was obscured by a streaming river of blood, too copious for him to blink away. Then the buffeting of heavy wing strokes burst around his head again. The last thing he felt was the point of the beak being driven deeply into his other eye.